session number 11963, Reel 3.
Captain Henderson, Reel, we were talking about the attack at Ypres on St. Julian, and you were unaware that there were a line of British troops in front of you. Could you explain that? What do you mean by that?
Well, we thought, or we were in the impression, that we were going to take St. Julian back from the Germans because they had taken it from us. But as it began to get dark that afternoon, and you could look back and see hundreds of our lads lying, you see. In fact, we had to get back if we wanted any tea or anything like that to see if any of them had anything in their bags. There was no chance of getting any rations, but that's only by the way. And I suddenly became aware that there were English soldiers in front of us.
You actually saw them?
Yes, saw them. And
there was a line, was there?
I mean, well, short of a line, you know. And
they weren't from your brigade?
They weren't from our brigade. Because I'll tell you why. As it got dark, there was an officer said, any Northumberland Fusiliers here? And we said, yes. He said, fall in. And they took the Northumberland Fusiliers back.
So you'd only really, you'd not been making an attack in a sense, you'd just been moving up to the front line.
Moving up to the front line, yeah. That's what it amounted to, see.
So
but we had this terrible fire to get through.
Were you aware it should have been done at night or done in a more sensible fashion at the time?
Well, see, the gas attack had put the wind up everybody. It was a thing to be talked about. And in the atmosphere of gas attacks and this sort of thing, I suppose you just went berserk with your thoughts.
So you thought it was just an honest mistake made by the higher command?
That's so.
When you went forward into this machine gun fire, that was your first time, obviously, under fire. Were you scared? I mean, how did you react to it? What did you think?
Well, I think there was a defiant element came up in my inside and said, I'm going to see it through. I'm on the move now and I can't do anything about it. That was my attitude, and it has always been in life. And I just decided to run on.
So although there were these bullets going past,
yeah,
you just decided you were just going to go on. That was
I knew what they were. I knew what they were because I'd gone through fighting practice at Morpeth. I knew what bullets were flying through the air, you know. And there were so many men falling. It was terrible.
Were you instructed not to help people who were wounded, or were you allowed to help?
Oh, no, you couldn't help anybody there, because if you stopped, you're likely to be shot with them. The Germans apparently had a clear firing range.
So you had no cover at all?
No cover at all, no cover.
And were any of your friends hit during the attack? Because you had a lot of casualties.
My friends? Oh, yes. Quite a lot. And what could you do? You couldn't go back to help them. That might have been taken as a cowardice or something like that. You had to go on. And in those days, of course, they treated cowards very harshly. There was quite a number of people shot in the First War, you know.
So, you advanced towards St. Julian. How did the advance come to a stop? Was it when you reached this line?
Line, yes.
And what did this line look like?
And it was a sort of a trench with no back on. In other words, a balustrade of land, you see. And we got there, there was soldiers of other regiments there.
Just a barricade, basically.
Just a barricade.
Not bugged down.
No. So if they expected we people to go into St. Julian as the retakers, they were wrong because there was English troops in front of us.
And how far from St. Julian was this line you came up to?
Oh, I should imagine, say, half a mile.
So you were still a long way from the village?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
How far had you advanced across this open land then, roughly? I know it's...
Oh, I should say a quarter of a mile.
So you'd been about a quarter of a mile under this heavy fire?
Under steady fire, yes.
And then got into this sort of...
This barricade of... Yeah, that's right.
How come you hadn't seen that barricade as you were advancing? Do you know?
Well, I don't think they were looking... You weren't looking for that, you see.
And
by that time, it was an April afternoon, and by that time it was getting dark. Early darkness, you know. And the first thing I knew was, after I sat down and said, well, that's over. What are we doing now? The whistle went, and there was a chap came round, an officer came round and shouted, Northumberland Fusiliers, fall in behind. And we fell in, and we were marched back.
Back the way you'd come?
Yes, back the way we'd come from.
And how did you feel about that?
Well, I had to say to myself, like many other people have said, it was a mistaken idea, or something poorly attempted.
Well, did it affect morale, either yours or the units, or A companies? I mean, what did people say? You'd had friends killed and that sort of thing. How did you feel?
I didn't, but it was things that were said afterwards that gave you that spirit of revolt. For instance, the next week after St. Julian, the battalion and the brigade were got together, what was left of it, you know, and the 6th Battalion of the Fusiliers was in front. Well, it was only about a quarter of a battalion because we'd had 800 casualties, you know. And the brigade, the inspecting officer said, you look as fit today as you did before you went into action. And the bloody lads were dropping on peace. They couldn't, some of them had to be, you know, carried away before the... Just one of these things, the wrong man saying the wrong thing. It was a disgrace.
So that sort of crystallised objections, what he said.
Yes.
So, after getting back then, so you'd been withdrawn, you'd gone forward, found this barricade trench, and then
withdrawn.
You'd been withdrawn the same night.
The same night.
What happened then, that same night, where did you go back to?
Well, we just slept in the fields.
You just pulled back out?
Yes, I just did the same as we had done before we came up, slept in the fields. And I remember it wasn't quite warm. But
and what was the date of the attack you went on? That was the 24th, was it?
And, April the 26th.
The 26th?
Yeah, that's right.
So on the 27th, you were just pulled back into the field?
That's right, yeah.
And what's the next thing you remember?
Well, we went back to... where was it again?
Not Haysbrook.
Eh?
Not Haysbrook.
Somewhere near, just in front of Haysbrook. And we did a bit of sorting out. And we got some people out from England.
You got a draft that early?
We got a draft out there, yes.
And then it was just, yet?
Eh?
Had you been promoted yet?
I was only a lance corporal then.
You'd been promoted, that's what I mean. You'd been promoted, so you were a lance corporal during the attack, were you?
That's right. Well, the next thing that happened was the brigade general would have the brigade out on parade to thank us for our work at St. Julian.
That was in between the time of the attack and when he made that tactless speech. That was the that was the only attack you did. You were just... Back in reserve the rest of the
week. Back in reserve, that's right, yeah.
And getting a new draft.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. And then we went into the line permanently after that.
And when did you go into the line?
Hoogewood.
And what state, what could you describe the situation at Hoogewood when you went in there?
The situation at Hoogewood was that the German line was only about 15 yards away from us. And it was a terrible place to be in. All sorts of things happened. You start to dig up your own dead after a while, you know, getting rid of the dead bodies. And I remember going out one night, and all I did was to take off people's...
dog tags.
What are they?
The tags.
Yeah, tag. I spent the whole night taking tags off dead men.
Now, I want to ask you, how long were you at in the Hooge sector, in and out of the line? You went there in May, would it be?
Yes, and we were in there, in and out of Hooge, for about 2 months, I should imagine.
So, to July, roughly speaking.
July, that's right, yes.
I'd like to ask you some questions about the conditions there, you know, about yeah. And how you lived, what trench life was like. How would you get, for instance, just the basics, how would you get into the front line at Hooge? I mean, how far back did the communication trenches go?
Well, at Hooge, you either, in parts, you had to drop into the trench from your field you were in. But there were always communication trenches, because they had to dump the rations every night, and they had to be sorted and brought up, you know. Terrible place it was, though. Nobody liked Hooge. It was one of these places in the line where that sort of thing was handy, throwing grenades at one another.
I'll come to, if we could stick to what the trenches were like, you know, so we get the basic.
Yeah, that's it.
What was the trench system like at Hooge? How many lines were there when you weren't there?
How many?
Lines, front, second, support, all that sort
well,
of thing.
Well, there was front line, and the remainder immediately behind that, the trenches were smashed to pieces, you know. Their useful life was ended.
So there was really only one line?
One line. And you had to get there by... There was only one trench anywhere near leading up to it. It was a difficult place to get to. It was a very dangerous place to be in. And it was a worse one to get out of.
And what was the front line like? Could you describe... How deep was the trench?
Oh, the deep... The line at Hooge was deep enough. I can remember being in Hooge. You had to keep your head down. You know, it's one of these places. And they fired, and we fired back. There was a lot of ammunition wasted, of course, in the war. They thought that when they saw a little bit of smoke coming up behind our trenches, we were making tea. So just to annoy us, they put one or two bullets into the soil and made it.
So about how deep would it be, the trench, would you say?
Oh, well, I should say 6 foot.
So if you were a tall man, you had to watch your head?
Oh, yes. Well, yes, the tall men soon learned to keep their heads down, you know.
Would there be a parapet and a parados?
That's right. Without any trimmings, mind... For instance, afterwards, we went in parts of the line where it was so quiet that the miners that we had taken from Newcastle and district, they could make a house nearly, make them nice. But at Hooge, there was nothing. It was a hell's hole.
Would you have a fire step?
Yes, or a little fire step that you made yourself, that's all. At Hooge, you had to improvise as things turned out.
Was it in bays?
Oh yes. All the trenches. I was never in a trench that was continuous for very long. Oh.
And did you have much barbed wire out the front at Hooge?
Oh yes, that's what stopped them from dropping into the trenches every night. And barbed wire.
About how thick would it be, yours and the Germans, and barbed wire?
Well, I've been in Hooge Wood where it was 15 yards from the front of our trench to the front of their trench.
And how much of that would be barbed wire?
The whole lot.
So there'd be nothing open at all?
No. You had to adopt methods like that or else they could walk over any night or creep over any night, you know.
Yes. What about your dugout? Did you have any sort of dugout at all at Hooge?
Oh, no, that was very poor. We had to depend upon our... waterproof sheets to give us.
So there'd be no dugout?
No, not in the usual sense. I've been in the trenches in France where you had dugouts to sleep in, dugouts to have your tea in, and all this sort of thing.
But none of that at Hooge?
Never in the Heap Salient.
Did at Hooge, would you dig out little cubby holes in the side? I don't mean dugouts, but just somewhere where you could get...
That's so.
You did that then?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which side would you dig them in? The side, the German side of it, or the opposite? Or both?
Where the Germans couldn't see any movement. New soil or anything like. Keep it away from the German sight. And we had to just do what we could. But I was never more thankful than in this world the day we pulled out of Hooge.
So you wouldn't have anything. Where would you put your kit, you know, when you weren't wearing it at Hooge? Would you just dump it on the side, or what would you do?
Oh, yes, just dump it where you knew where you put it, you see. If it wasn't there, if it had been hit by a shell, it wasn't there when you went for it.
What about...
But all we had was waterproof sheets. And by that time, we were beginning to get steel helmets.
I'll ask you a bit more about that, because I know they came in later. What about the rations at Hooge? How would the rations be brought up? Would you send parties back, or would the reserve battalions send the rations forward? How was it arranged?
Well, there was always each battalion, and they pass it on as each relieved each other. There was a point where you could safely unload your rations in the dark, take them over your shoulder and get them up into the trenches.
And who would actually fetch them? The battalion in the line would go send a party back?
Yes, oh yes, we had to leave the line, our own line, go back.
A party?
Yes. For instance, I was looking after the mail for a long time, and I had to go back to see if there was any letters for the mail and come up with the rationers.
Oh, well, we might as well do that job of the mail, soon as you mentioned it, because that's a question later on. Would the men get, or would you get many letters in the line?
The custom was that only letters were delivered up into the line. Parcels were kept at the quartermaster stores until the lads came out of the line.
But all the mail, the letters went up?
All the letters went up.
Would you get many letters yourself?
Oh, yes.
So who would write to you?
My mother wrote, and Pa wrote occasionally, you know. And Pa came to see me one day. He was one of these chaps who was employed by the government to carry things that other people might think he wasn't carrying, you see. He came to see me one day when I came out of the line.
Your father was there?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And did you write home yourself regularly?
Oh, yes. I tried to keep a letter going at least once a month. But otherwise, there was field postcards, you know, and you cross out the necessary.
And would you send them a lot? Or did you use them a lot?
Yes, I did. Not so much to my mother and father, but to friends who I'd gone to school with. Or things like that, you know.
So, and were letters very important to the men in the trenches?
Oh, definitely. Then I was engaged for some time by the colonel to write to people whose boys had been killed and things like that, you know, returning their registered letters and this sort of thing, and saying how sorry we were. It was all done properly.
That can't have been a very nice job.
Oh, no, it wasn't. It was funny the jobs you had to get used to in the army. There were that many men being killed and buried, and you tried to put a cross there, and they asked me one day, was I any good at printing? And I said, no, I wasn't. The next day, there was a chap saw me doing letters with a paintbrush, you know? He says, you were just the man that went down the street to make the crosses out. And below, they had me making crosses out because I could make letters with the paintbrush.
That was at Hooge, was it?
Yes. You had to adapt yourself. But I found one thing, that when you were instructed to build a new latrine, you started to dig in, you were digging your own corpses.
I'll come back to that, because that's a subject we're going to ask about. So, getting back to, we were talking about you bringing the mail up, that's how we got onto this, and the rations would come up as well. What sort of food would you get in the front line? Can you remember?
Oh, mainly bully beef. You can put that down immediately. And thank God there was such a thing as bully beef, because it was a standby, and of course in your iron rations, which you carried in your jacket, you had a tin of bully beef and two hard biscuits. And otherwise than that, you got little treats. They did send little treats up.
What was the bully beef like? I mean, it's what we call corned beef now.
Corned beef.
How did it compare with the quality of corned beef we get now? I mean, was it good corned beef?
I should say it's exactly the same. The same, of course, the same machines are making it now as made it in those days. I don't think there's been that much change.
And did you get sick of it, or...?
No. I've made roads with tins of corned beef in France. One day, they were wanting this place blocked up to allow the ration carts to come across, you know.
That would be later, though, wouldn't it?
Later.
I'll come back to that. I'll make a note and come back to So you've got a lot of corned beef.
Yeah.
What else would you get?
A stew.
Would that be hot?
Hot, yes. After a while in the trenches, when we first went up the line, you had to make your own tea. You had to make your own whatever you wanted. You were given bully beef out of the rations, a loaf of bread and this sort of thing. And you're on your own. But afterwards, after Ypres, we got into a system whereby they appointed company cooks.
But would you have that while you were at Hooge?
No.
So Hooge, it would be mainly tinned food, would it?
Tinned food, that's right, yes.
What other types of tin did you get? Did you get the McConaughey's, for instance?
James William McConaughey ran a monarchy on his own. There's a song about it. And McConaughey was the first tin to open where you got a meal, and it contained potatoes, carrots and turnips, you know.
Did it have much meat in it?
Oh, yes, it were very good.
You liked them?
Oh, yes, McConaughey's. I lived on McConaughey's at one time.
And you got them at Hooge?
No, not at Hooge. We hadn't advanced that far.
Ah, I see. Would you get any other tins at Hooge, or was it purely the bully?
I can't remember getting anything. It was mainly getting a part of a loaf of bread and bully beef. That was our...
What about the biscuits?
And a few biscuits, yes, oh, yes.
Was the bread all right?
Oh, yes, it was always good.
What about the biscuits? What were they like?
Well, as hard as, you know, in fact, your emergency rations that you carried with your tin of corned beef were that hard, you had to break them with a hammer.
Did they damage your teeth?
Well, yes, I think a lot of the lads broke their teeth on emergency biscuits, you know. They gave you the order when you had to eat them if there was nothing had come up in the rations.
So while you were at Hooge, you wouldn't get these little treats?
Oh, no, there was no treats at Hooge. By Jove, none at all.
Did you get enough to eat at Hooge?
I should say yes.
But it was just bully beef and bread and biscuits?
That's right, nothing more.
Nothing else at all?
Nothing else, no.
What about water or tea or water ration? How did you get your at Hooge? How did you get your water?
Well, it was sent up to the line in canisters, you know, and each man was allowed a billy can. You know what a billy can is, and you had to boil that to get a cup of tea.
So the tea wouldn't come up ready made. I mean,
no.
You were making your own.
But when we got these company cooks.
We'll come back to that. I'll ask you about that. Yeah. So, at the start, you had to just do your own tea. You get your water.
Absolutely.
How would you get... Would your tea leaves and your sugar come up then?
Yes, oh yes. You got your sugar. And at Hooge, it was a question if you're getting your stuff warmed and looked at before they start the fire. Because once they start the fire, they were firing so much at times that they covered everything with soil and whatnot.
Just small arms. Fire would do that.
Absolutely.
And how would you try and start a fire? I mean, it's not that easy to start a fire in May.
Now we are getting on to the difficult part. Well, we had boxes of matches, of course, which you had to look after most carefully if there was a wind blowing or anything like that. And what you used to do was to stuff your pockets with dry paper if you could, and have a supply going. Because it didn't take a billy can long to warm up sufficiently to make yourself a cup of hot tea. And you did want something hot. But whether the Germans ever saw my smoke coming away, I don't know. But I was never troubled much. I've had a supply of earth cover my meal at times, but it came from a distance, you know.
What about, so you got, you had this water. Did you have enough, or tea? Was that enough to drink for you at Hooge?
Oh, no. If you'd seen the lads in the line and having their drinks and watched their preparation and the danger, then saw them out of the line on rest. They had the wagons in those days, of course, the battalion wagons. You'd see how they enjoyed their tea.
So but they didn't get enough in the line?
Oh, no. Enough to keep body and soul together.
But so you had enough. You had food was all right. You had enough food.
Yeah.
And it was a bit boring, but you had enough. Water, you had enough to keep body and soul together, but not enough to make you happy.
No. how nice. Oh, how nicely you do put it.
But that's how it was would be.
That's right. Yeah,
the
that's
water was more of a problem than
yeah,
food.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Did you get at Hooge, still sticking to Hooge, 1915, would you get a rum ration or a cigarette ration up in the line?
We got a rum ration. And occasionally a cigarette ration.
How was the rum ration dealt out?
Well, there was an NCO, when the battalion went into the line, it was in progression, of course. There were certain companies in the line, certain in immediate reserve, and then others in general reserve, you see, they follow each other. And their corporal, or a sergeant, took the bottle of rum round the troops. And he had a little measure, which he filled, you see, and he told you to drink it off. Or probably if you had a measure, he would put it in there for you. You just took your time.
Did he watch you drink it?
Oh, yes. There was no skiving or giving it to somebody else.
Were you made to drink? I mean, if you were teetotal, were you allowed not to bother?
Oh, well, if you were teetotal and you didn't want any, that was all right.
But if you took your rum ration, you had to drink it straight away.
Drink it there and then, that's right.
And I've, why was that? Why were they so? Was that to stop you saving it up? Or?
Yes, and passing it on to somebody else. If somebody had three rations, they might, you know, be funny. But I felt hot. I felt rum going down, and I could feel my body was in such a state that the rum tasted hot. I was that weak.
Do you think the rum did you good then? I mean,
oh yes, it gave you a feeling for the next half hour that you could do anything. You know.
What about the cigarette ration? Did you smoke before you went into the army?
No.
Did you smoke after, when you were in the army?
I've smoked in the army just to let people be happy. When you had a fella who was lying on a stretcher and you knew his end had to come soon and he wanted a cigarette, you gave him a cigarette and you lit one up just to keep him company.
So you weren't a smoker?
I never have been.
But would you smoke all your ration or would you give most of it away?
Oh, give most of it away. Most of it away.
What were the cigarettes like? Were they any good?
Well, they were what they called Red Hussar. Red Hussar. I don't know who they were made by. It was a nice name.
What were they like?
Oh, they were hard. What I call harsh, really. Not a cigarette like a gold flake or anything like that, you know. But they did the lads a good turn. They got them for nothing.
And you had your first cigarettes in the line then?
That's right, yes, yeah. Yeah.